This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The world suffers the largest outbreak of disease in history. At the same time, climate disruption brings a heat wave to Alaska and Greenland, pushing Arctic air south where it should not be. Is this breakdown or turning point? We begin with new science on a fear almost greater than death, long-haul COVID. The monster COVID wave is hitting around the world like a tsunami, as you know. Formerly safe places like Australia and Vietnam have skyrocketing cases. Even Israel, now administering the fourth dose of vaccines and closing borders, they cannot contain this. Positive COVID tests in Europe are far higher than ever. The disease is conquering America and Canada. Russia continues to lose over 1,000 citizens a day. Hospitalizations are building again everywhere, but more slowly than expected. The best hope, sold by the media and desperate tweeters, goes like this. The new Omicron variant is mild, just a bad cold, sort of. Omicron pushes out the more deadly Delta variant and infects everyone, including all the unvaccinated. Humanity emerges in the spring with just another nasty flu that comes back every year. That sounds livable. Many politicians who tossed out restrictions to keep business going, well, maybe they were right. We might as well just keep on going and get our dose of COVID. Most people will be okay, we think. If you are happy with that, or in case you are genuinely depressed right now, you might want to change the channel or stop the podcast here. I'm serious. Protect yourself. In these times, we all need to cling on to whatever gets us through the day. Get out now if you need to, because this is harsh information. The dream of mild Omicron accidentally saving humanity from a more deadly strain is possible, but is it likely? As every expert says relentlessly on TV, we don't know. It is still too soon to tell how the Omicron variant will play out in the real world. In South Africa, the first giant wave of Omicron swept through in early December without a parallel wave of immediate hospitalizations. But immunologists pointed out two prime factors. The population of South Africa is much younger than in Europe or North America, and a large number of those infected may have built resistance from previously untested and unreported cases of earlier COVID variants. The South African experience may not apply. At the start of 2022, hospitalizations in South Africa are climbing again. In Britain, Omicron flourished to the point where 1 in 10 people on the streets of London tested positive for COVID at the end of December. Now, that's not 1 in 10 people who went in for testing because they thought they were sick, but 1 in 10 randomly selected people on the street. And yet, so far, hospitalizations have not completely overwhelmed the national healthcare system. That could change at any day. Also, the majority of people who tested positive for COVID in UK hospitals at the end of December were there for other reasons. They were not admitted because of COVID symptoms. That's amazing. We don't know what will happen in January. The United States is a special case. First of all, the population was led into a dangerous myth, not just by people pushing anti-science, but by the government's Center for Disease Control. The CDC helped that hopeful narrative that kinder, gentler Omicron had pushed out Delta. In early December, they reported that 73% of new cases were the Omicron variant. But on December 28th, the CDC made a major correction. Instead of 73% Omicron in the first 2 weeks of December, the true figure was 23%, a change of 50%. The majority of cases were deadly Delta. Who knows how many people let their guard down because of that? I think their guard was already down. But the Delta variant continued to overwhelm hospitals and kill thousands of Americans each and every day. There were two pandemics at the same time. Deadly Delta has not in any way left the United States, Canada, or Europe yet. One review of cases, still not peer-reviewed, appears to show that having Omicron seems to prevent Delta at the same time. Others argue co-infection is completely possible. We don't know for sure, especially from the experience in Israel, whether Omicron can infect people, even with 3 injections of vaccines. That seems to be the case. The virus has mutated to escape vaccine resistance, and it looks like triple jab people still avoid the trip to intensive care or the morgue unless they were already near the edge due to other non-COVID conditions. So don't count on immunity. Medical reports from several countries found people can be reinfected with COVID, getting it 2 or more times within a single year. So this is unlike other famous diseases. Surviving COVID does not create lifetime immunity or even immunity lasting a year. My personal conclusion is that people who have had COVID-19 of any variant, whether symptomatic or not, should take more, not less, protective measures. Cases on record show return COVID can be worse and more deadly than the first bout. Hopefully you can pass this message on to others. If someone got through COVID, it is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, not time to party. It is time to be extra vigilant and double-masked like an immunocompromised person, which that person may very well be. We need more science on that, but peer-reviewed large study results will come far too late to know what to do now for sure. Be careful. The giant and most fearsome ogre in our time is not really how many millions will die from COVID, their troubles will end while their families grieve. The media mentions this other dark fear in passing. Maybe a couple of famous people admit it. We hear more cries from victims on Twitters. Hey, watch out. You know what it is. Long-haul COVID. Early in the pandemic, we heard of low survival rates of people going on ventilators, like only 12% lived. Among those survivors, a minority of that minority experienced extreme impacts like full-on dementia at any age. Others had to learn to speak and walk again, like a toddler. It is hard to find the number of people who now require dialysis for the rest of their lives because of their COVID infection. Kidney damage, heart damage, and brain damage emerged in COVID survivors and sometimes even in those with mild symptoms. Others just lost their will to live, slipping into serious depression that lasts until today. Or they are tired, finding common ground with chronic fatigue syndrome, too tired to work, to look after their kids, to get their lives back. We do not know how long those symptoms will last. Organ damage to the kidneys and heart will not be repaired, we know that. They may be treated, but the person may die years younger than if they never had COVID. When this pandemic is over, it will not be over. It seems likely millions of people will die early due to COVID damage for the years and even decades after the disease. Most may not be counted. What we can say that is true now, just based on the lives already lost and damaged by the COVID-19 pandemic, is that widespread damage will continue as long as variants like Delta can find unvaccinated people. Given a big world with billions of humans, that could be decades. We can't say for sure. Will the Omicron variant cause the same kinds of long-term impacts? With a virus barely a month old, it is too soon to say with any scientific or medical certainty. We don't know yet. We can say that so far it looks like Omicron is having less severe impacts on most people who get it, especially if they are vaccinated. And that might reduce the continuing buildup of humans with long-haul COVID. A comparatively smaller number of Omicron patients require ventilators. If hospitalized, patients with Omicron stay only a few days, not weeks or months. It sounds like fewer people are dying of Omicron, but the big wave is just washing over. It is too soon to know. But we can hold on to that small hope that fewer people will suffer long-lasting damage when they get this new COVID variant. That is a good hope, and I'm holding on to it. There is no science to prove it yet, but we are getting the first explanations of how and when COVID-19 damages the heart, brain, and other organs.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Let's get straight to the breaking science on long-haul COVID. This was just released December 26th, led by scientists at the U.S. National Institute of Health. These are rushed results from fresh autopsies of American COVID victims? This information comes with a warning. It is preprint and, quote, should not be considered conclusive, used to inform clinical practice, or referenced by the media as validated information, end quote. Due to the enormous need to understand this virus as it attacks society around the world, the NIH is breaking their normal slow procedure for peer-reviewed data. There are 33 authors, most of them American medical scientists. The lead author is Dr. Daniel Chertow. He is the investigator for the Emerging Pathogens section of the NIH. The manuscript is under review for the top journal, Nature. The title is SARS-CoV-2 Infection and Persistence Throughout the Human Body and Brain. I post links to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for it, published Wednesdays. You should also look for an article by Jason Gale at medscape.com. Headline is Coronavirus Can Persist for Months After Traversing the Body. Jason writes, quote, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 can spread within days from the airwaves to the heart, brain, and almost every organ in the body, where it may persist for months, a study found, end quote. The best previous study on long-term effects was led by the director of the Clinical Epidemiology Center at the Veterans Affairs in St. Louis, Missouri, Dr. Ziad Al-Ali. We will look at his paper shortly. But Ziad Al-Ali told Jason Gale, quote, for a long time now, we have been scratching our heads and asking why long COVID seems to affect so many organ systems. This paper sheds some light and may help explain why long COVID can occur even in people who had mild or asymptomatic acute disease, end quote. So what did the NIH scientists find in the bodies of COVID victims? The COVID RNA particles were found in the brain and in multiple parts of the body, lasting hundreds of days after symptoms began. The RNA, that is, the virus, is still there. It is still active, but can it be activated again? We don't know yet. But other viruses do have that capability, like the herpes virus, which hides in the bodies for years, erupting every now and then. We can't assume COVID-19 is like that, and we can't assume that it isn't. But even more telling for millions of people experiencing illness and disability long after getting this coronavirus, the new NIH study suggests the way that spreading can take place. The investigators found the virus goes through an early stage where it can explode out of the breathing system into the rest of the body. They are calling it a viremic stage. Take a deep breath. Not everyone experiences this all-body blast of the virus. In fact, the majority of people do not. Yet a minority, say 1% of people who get COVID, is a huge number of people when literally billions of folks are infected with the virus. In the UK's Guardian newspaper, December 23rd, disability activist J.D. Davids draws up these numbers for America, quote, we now know that at least 10 to 30% of those who survive any COVID infection, from asymptomatic to mild to severe, will go on to live with, and sometimes die from, long COVID, a long-term, lifelong, or even life-threatening from COVID. Even before Omicron, the CDC estimates there have been at least 146.6 million COVID infections in the United States alone, meaning at least 15 million people are estimated to have long COVID. End quote from J.D. Davids in The Guardian. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That 15 million figure is lower than others I have seen. It is just for the United States and does not include whatever Omicron will leave in its wake in the year 2022 and possibly beyond.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, host of the show for the last 15 years. I usually interview climate scientists, but this week we have a special about new understanding of one of the most feared aspects of this pandemic virus, long-haul COVID. Here is the awful truth found by the latest science. It is already known to doctors and nurses in many intensive care units around the world. In some people, COVID kills neurons in the brain. Here's a tweet, a helpful one, from Dr. Noor Bari, an infectious diseases emergency trainee in Australia. Quote, "They found that the infected astrocytes induced apoptosis in the neurons, indicating that the virus infection could trigger events that could kill neurons." Translation? COVID makes your body kill your brain cells, and they don't grow back. That from Noor Bari is partly inspired by this paper published November 18, 2021 in Nature Reviews Neurology. The title is Counting the Neurological Cost of COVID-19. In it, an earlier review of reports from 55 countries found 41 different neurological manifestations occurring with COVID-19. The brain is so complex, damaging different parts of it reveals 41 different possible impacts. That is amazing, and that's just what's reported so far. A lot of people are experiencing strange changes in their lives and may never realize it was COVID damage to the brain. The most extreme signs of brain damage from the virus are like early onset dementia and Parkinson's disease. Although surviving, the person may require care for the rest of their shortened lives. Other symptoms seem like less, but they still loom pretty large if it's you. Memory problems are common, words going missing. The brain breakdown formerly associated with advancing age, but now it appears in 30 to 50-year-olds and younger, even kids. Some people with COVID lose detectable and measurable IQ points due to neurons killed off by the disease in the brain. Quoting from Counting the Neurological Cost, that study by Abdul Manan Baig, differences in the prevalence of the various neurological symptoms were observed between older, aged 60 years or more, and young, aged less than 18-year-olds, subpopulations. Acute confusion or delirium, fatigue, and myalgia tended to dominate in the older group. In patients under 18 years, the most common neurological symptoms were impairment of smell and or taste and headache, and seizures were also noted in some individuals. Alarmingly, mortality in patients with COVID-19 who had one or more neurological manifestations was found to be 27% and was especially high in patients aged 60 years or more. The finding that the prevalence of stroke was 1.2% in people with COVID-19 compared with only 0.2% in those with influenza, is also very concerning. That's an end quote from Counting the Neurological Cost by Abdul Manan Baig. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Statistically speaking, this COVID brain damage probably has not happened to you, will not happen to you or your loved ones. But millions of people around you will be less able to work, to cope, and to understand what is happening to them. Take this back-of-the-envelope guesstimate from a tweeter who calls himself Abundant Pedestrian Sheds. Quote, "Let's do a bit more math. Let's say 70% get infected. 10% of that has long COVID. A UK study says 1 in 7, so 10% is conservative enough. That will give us roughly 23 million of people in the UK who will have apoptosis in brain cells and long COVID. Plus, reinfections are twice as likely to be fatal." That's from a tweeter. How about this one? Just consider from Denise DeWald, an MD in Ohio. "How is the economy going to look if the average age of dementia onset is 60 years rather than 84? There is a measurable decline in cognitive function in people who had just one episode of COVID. What happens after multiple bouts with the virus?" says Denise. Back comes this comment. "Meanwhile, China is protecting its citizens' workforce. Hardcore. How will we compete if our populace is profoundly affected cognitively in years to come?" Another commenter says, "Try from age 35. I am dealing with completely lost and confused people daily. We have already discussed, discreetly, screening those who have been infected when hiring. They are too great a burden for a business when thinking fast on your feet is essential." End of a quote from a tweet. Chilling. How many people will try to hide their COVID infection in job resumes? How deep will the new discrimination go? a factor in marriage partners? For more information on brain damage and cognitive deficits after COVID, you can check out this paper, published July 22, 2021, in the journal Lancet, Cognitive Deficits in People Who Have Recovered from COVID-19. Another study, published in the Lancet April 6, 2021, in a huge UK look at medical records, found 1 in 3 COVID patients developed either neurological or psychiatric problems in the first 6 months after their infection. Damage ranges from nervous disorders to depression to paranoia, and beyond that into antisocial behaviors. It can appear in COVID patients of all ages. That includes children, parents, and grandparents. I don't have time in this show to go into the psychiatric changes after COVID-19, but remember, that just hits a few. But in this game, a few is a lot, too many to count. As mentioned, Dr. Ziad Al-Ali published an important paper on long-haul COVID in April 2021. He is senior author of the study and a director of the Clinical Epidemiology Center at Veterans Affairs in St. Louis. In a news release from Washington University in St. Louis, Al-Ali said, "Our study demonstrates that up to 6 months after diagnosis, the risk of death following even a mild case of COVID-19 is not trivial and increases with disease severity. Given that more than 30 million Americans have been infected with this virus, and given that the burden of long COVID is substantial, the lingering effects of this disease will reverberate for many years and even decades." End quote. Al-Ali also warned that our current death tolls in every country are just the beginning. Quote, "As far as total pandemic death toll, these numbers suggest that the deaths we are counting due to the immediate viral infection are only the tip of the iceberg," end quote. As the WUSTL press release explains, quote, "For the Nature study, researchers examined more than 87,000 COVID-19 patients and nearly 5 million control patients in a federal database. They found COVID-19 patients had a 59% higher risk of death up to 6 months after infection compared to non-infected people. These findings translate into about 8 extra deaths per 1,000 patients over 6 months because many deaths caused by long-term COVID complications are not recorded as COVID-19 deaths," the researchers said. "Among patients who were hospitalized and died after more than 30 days, there were 29 excess deaths per 1,000 patients over 6 months," end quote, from that press release. In this meta-study of about 74,000 patient records held by the Veterans Administration, the Al-Ali paper found COVID-19 can result in, get ready for it, respiratory system, persistent cough, shortness of breath, and low oxygen levels in the blood, nervous system, stroke, headaches, memory problems, and problems with senses of taste and smell, mental health, anxiety, depression, sleep problems, and substance abuse, metabolism, new onset of diabetes, obesity, and high cholesterol, cardiovascular system, acute coronary disease, heart failure, heart palpitations, and irregular heart rhythms, gastrointestinal system, constipation, diarrhea, and acid reflux, kidney, acute kidney injury, and chronic kidney disease that can, in severe cases, require dialysis, coagulation regulation, blood clots in the legs and lungs, skin, rash and hair loss, musculoskeletal system, joint pain and muscle weakness, general health, malaise, fatigue, and anemia. That ends a long list from a study of tens of thousands of people. And that's what can happen after COVID-19. It will happen to a minority of people, but that minority will be a huge number of people. Let's care for them. People who worry they have long-haul COVID, or know that they do, or who need to support someone who does have it, can try the Survivor Corps, a grassroots group, at www.survivorcorps.com, and CORE has an S on the end of it. Okay, it's time to talk about the massive risk of Omicron evolving into a new variant. One final awful truth to get through here. the historic infection of billions of people worldwide in a few months greatly increases the odds a new and worse variant of COVID will develop and escape. Even if this one is milder, which we don't know yet, the worldwide virus factory growing in so many people is another darkening cloud on the time horizon. Early in the pandemic, immunologists explained a new COVID variant could develop within a single sick person. Each person with the virus has billions of copies of it. Medical scientists suggest that someone who survives a long time while sick with one COVID variant is a possible bioreactor where a new variant can form. Actually, every person with COVID becomes a new bioreactor, an experimental chamber for the virus to try and try again countless new variations. It only requires one, even more successful variation to reconquer the human herd and a lot of other mammals. By the way, a third of the deer tested in Ohio tested positive for COVID-19. Whatever strain the deer have is probably going to be endemic in humans, where infected wildlife is present, and they don't have herd immunity either. If you want to collect up all your COVID fears and put them on the table, don't forget the massively increased risk of new variants as uncontrolled Omicron and the remains of Delta blow up disease records around the world right now. As doctors like Peter Hotez and Eric Fagelding continually warn, the more cases we have, the more chance of dangerous variants developing, perhaps to escape any vaccine or treatment we have now. The greatest wave of disease ever seen on Earth carries the awful seed, the possibility of even worse to come. Or maybe not. Remember the first SARS-1? Far more lethal than SARS-2, which we call COVID-19. It evolved away from human hosts. A vaccine for SARS-1 was just developed, but never used because a new variation disappeared from human experience. It was a warning shot. A small group of virus experts, and eventually Bill Gates, got the message. Sadly, governments and the public did not, and here we are. But if this is our darkest hour, remember the virus has no planning intelligence. It changes through billions of trials by brute force of numbers to see what succeeds better. We have failed to fight off the virus, but the virus can fail too. That hope remains. Whether Omicron saves us from more deadly Delta, or new treatments for acute illness arrive during 2022, we can be sure that the impacts of this viral event will last for decades. Millions of people have already lost key functions, with damage in organs and reduced energy to live their full lives. Their lifespans could be shorter. Even the average life expectancy could be reduced, including in developed countries. Now we face coping with millions of injured people. Hordes of Americans already lost their health care along with their jobs. Those who are too sick and tired to work may not get medical care. But it goes deeper than providing basic living or even health care. This pandemic is going to require something else. It has been in short supply this last decade. Caring for others, including people who look or speak differently. In history, religion has stepped in to provide emotional and spiritual support for those in need. Charity is built into Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But all three religions are declining in the age of science and modernity. Will a frightened people return to former faiths and customs? Will we see a religious revival? If not, the pandemic may force a new function into civilization from Asia to Arkansas. We need a new social mechanism to care for our wounded. This includes hundreds of thousands of kids who lost their parents, the new COVID orphans. It includes the bright college professor who lost the IQ needed to keep on teaching. It includes the Amazon warehouse worker now stuck in bed at home without support or benefits. It includes the Indian farmer who can't support the family. Millions of COVID injured now need help from the survivors. That is our challenge in a time when selling hate and division is so profitable. Can the pandemic finally bring out the best in us? Anything is possible. I'm Alex Smith. Find links to all the science and news I just talked about, plus this audio MP3 as a free download, in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When the Arctic reemerges from its long sleep in the cold, everything from port cities to global weather are affected. But is anybody watching the big picture there? The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just issued their 2021 Arctic Report Card update. A lead editor of that report is glaciologist Twyla Moon. Dr. Moon is deputy lead scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado. From Boulder, Colorado, Twyla Moon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Without a lie, most of us are transfixed by the pandemic, but we do have to be able to pay attention to more than one thing at a time. Did the Arctic continue to change in fundamental ways in 2021?
There's no question that rapid change has continued across the Arctic. 2021 was no exception. 2021 was not a year of significant new records in regards to, you know, record-breaking temperatures. But nonetheless, there were still unprecedented events that occurred in the Arctic, and we are seeing dramatic changes that include landscapes, animals, frozen elements of the Arctic. So it's an area of concern.
Well, there was one record set just a couple of weeks ago. The World Meteorological Organization verified the highest temperature ever recorded in the Arctic. In June 2021, I think it was, the Siberian town experienced an astonishing 38 degrees C or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What does the report card say about rising temperatures and even maybe heat waves in the Arctic?
You are correct. That is a new single-day record temperature recording. For the year overall, and the Arctic report card generally looks at the year from October of one year through September of the next year. That way we capture the period, the frozen period in winter, and then the thawing period in summer. And over October 2020 to September 2021 was actually the seventh warmest year on record for the Arctic. But this is another year, the eighth consecutive year, where that surface air temperature in the Arctic is more than 1 degree Celsius above the long-term average. And the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the globe. It depends on the season and exactly the time period you look at, but those rates can be as much as four times faster than warming in other parts of the globe.
Yes, I saw that in a tweet from Zeke Labe, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, from the University of Colorado, saying that the Arctic is warming nearly four times faster than the global average. That seems so impossible. How is that happening?
There are a few different factors at play that are helping the Arctic warm faster, and this is a process overall that we refer to as Arctic amplification. One of the processes at play is that as we're losing sea ice on the Arctic Ocean, that sea ice is producing a nice, bright, fairly white surface that, just like wearing a white t-shirt, is pretty good at reflecting solar radiation back out to space. But as we lose that sea ice, we reveal a very, very dark ocean surface. And thinking to pictures you've seen of the Earth from space, that the ocean almost looks black in instances. And that ocean, dark ocean surface, is very good at absorbing additional solar radiation. And then that heat in the ocean can then be released during fall and into winter, causing delayed warming there. And another process that we have happening in the Arctic is that as we're warming the air temperature, the air is actually better able to hold water vapor. And water vapor is, in fact, a greenhouse gas. So as we're having more water vapor in the atmosphere in the Arctic as it warms, we're also warming the temperature.
Do you think the changes in the Arctic have helped destabilize weather further south in both summer and winter?
Yes, there is now clear evidence. This has been a very active area of research, and there are results now indicating ways in which the Arctic does reach down and influence storms, for example, in lower and mid-latitudes. And there are actually quite a few ways in which the Arctic is connected to all of us who are sitting far away from the Arctic. That includes influencing storms and weather, also influencing sea level rise and the effects at our coast. And the Arctic also has a lot of frozen ground or permafrost, and as that thaws, it can also release additional greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and cause additional warming that influences us far away from the Arctic.
I thought I would see more about the permafrost in this new report card. I'm wondering, is a lack of data holding up what we know? I mean, just about the greenhouse gases that may come out there and the landscape changes, it seems like a big deal.
There are significant changes in the permafrost. The Arctic report card is set up so that we have seven what we call vital signs, which are metrics that we look at every year in the Arctic report card. And then we have indicators, and those we come back to every couple of years. And permafrost is one of those indicators that shows up every few Arctic report cards. And then we also have essays that we term frost bites, and these are sort of emerging themes or research areas in the Arctic. And this year, we had a section focusing on glacier and permafrost hazards. So not just the state of thawing ground in the Arctic, but what are these kinds of hazards that are caused as we get glacial melt happening, destabilizing ground as we thaw permafrost. And this can produce large landslides. Sometimes those are coastal, and can end up in the water and producing large tsunamis. So there are really critical threats both to infrastructure, buildings, and as well as to lives as we see changing glacier and permafrost in the Arctic.
And on this show, we recently heard Canadian scientist Michelle McChrystal talking about new science showing the Arctic will get more rain than snow in the future, and it's already starting to happen. How important is that?
Yes, that is a big change, and it is an important one. It's related to what we've been referring to in this Arctic report card as an intensification of the hydrologic cycle. So we see more precipitation happening as rain. One of the ways that we see this increased water hydrologic activity is by a trend of increasing river discharge across the Arctic as well. But I think one of the challenges is that this increase in kind of moisture water activity isn't equal everywhere or all across the seasons. So, for example, in our river discharge section, which is another one of these metrics we revisit every few years, some of the data from 2020 indicates that there was extraordinarily large river discharge in May of 2020, for example, for Eurasian Arctic rivers, but then that was followed by an extraordinarily low discharge in June. So we can have this kind of flip-flopping of extremes, and we can also see how some of these differences around the Arctic play out, for example, in the greenness of the tundra vegetation, which overall the Arctic is greening, and we've had some remarkably green years recently. But because of local extreme events or other local instances of what's happening with the weather, we can also see browning occurring.
In your TEDx talk in Montana, you told the audience it's not too late to prevent major changes in Earth's climate. But when it comes to the ice world, NASA says the collapse of Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier is, quote, unstoppable. And other scientists suggest the big melt has already been triggered in the Arctic. Can we really stop now the decline of the ice world? What do you think?
Well, I think what is so important to emphasize here is not A to Z, but rather how quickly these changes are happening. So we're at a point where future sea level rise is going to occur, and over the next couple of decades, that sea level rise may look similar regardless of whether we have very high or very low emissions. But a couple of decades from now, around 2050, computer simulations suggest that we'll start to see this divergence that is fully dependent on human action now. And that divergence is the beginning to experiencing very, very different sea level rise outcomes. If we have strong action and really work to reduce greenhouse gas and polluting gas emissions and tackle climate change, we will be seeing a much slower rate of sea level rise, and we're likely not to get to some of the higher numbers that have been discussed for at minimum centuries, but maybe millennia. That, in contrast to continuing to produce a lot of polluting gases and raising global temperatures, is really going to increase and keep sea level rise happening quickly and also reaching very high values. So some of these processes are underway, and we can't at this point stop them from happening, but human action still has a very big control on how quickly these changes happen. And the more we can slow these changes, the more time we give ourselves and our communities and economies, coastlines, time to adapt.
And then we have an idea from John Moore, a scientist with institutions in Beijing and Finland. He argued, if trillions of dollars of coastal real estate is at risk, and it is, we should try to slow the flow of new water coming from a relatively small number of glaciers. He suggests we could do it with geoengineering. Is that a good idea?
Yes, I'm quite familiar with some of his ideas on polar geoengineering. And I want to be clear, geoengineering is a very broad umbrella. And in order to reach some of our temperature targets, for example, reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, limiting our warming to that number, does require that we use technologies that remove carbon dioxide and other polluting gases from the atmosphere. And certainly that is a form of geoengineering in which we're removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing that in permanent ways. And that is a very important part of reaching some of our goals for limiting warming. But there are also other forms of geoengineering, such as the ideas that he's put forth, which suggest some very local infrastructure that I tend to shy away from recommending as activities for us to undertake. Many of them are logistically difficult or unproven, and work in polar environments is also fantastically difficult and also expensive. Rather than putting Band-Aids on these more local issues, if we are really focusing on the root cause of changes in the Arctic, that is climate change, and that root cause is also affecting many of the other challenges we're experiencing, like increased wildfires, additional drought, more flooding. And so we can focus on this root cause and have an impact that is going to influence many of these different areas where we've been having challenges with environmental disasters.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, and we're talking with our guest, Twyla Moon. So does the accumulated mass of the glaciers drive them to move faster? And if so, could the melt eventually slow down as the world continues to warm?
An important part of being a glacier on the Earth, an important part of that definition is that that ice is moving. So if you have an area of some permanent ice, but it's not moving, it might be quite small, we would consider that a permanent ice field or snow field. But the world's glaciers, ice caps, which cover Patagonia, the Andes, Himalaya, as well as the Earth's large ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, all of these are defined by that ice being in motion. And ice around the world is not all responding in the same way as far as how it's changing its speed. And largely that's because it depends on the shape of the landscape and topography underneath that ice, whether, for example, around Greenland, where we see all of the edge of the ice sheet there is in retreat. And there, in some instances, we have glaciers that are retreating actually into deeper topography underneath them, and that causes that glacier to speed up. While another glacier may be retreating up higher onto land, and that can cause that glacier to slow down. So the speed of ice motion is not intrinsically always in one direction or another with climate change. Unfortunately, how quickly ice moves is not the only thing that is adding ice to our ocean. We're having surface melt. We can break off large chunks of frozen ice as icebergs, and that melts in the ocean. So we're losing ice mass not simply by increasing its pace towards the ocean.
And several of our scientific guests report big changes in the timing of snow cover on Arctic lands from Alaska to Canada and Siberia. How important is that?
Yes, this is a very important issue. Snow cover has a lot to do with when we're getting water resources on the landscape, and this has been an area of change as well. For example, we've been tracking terrestrial snow cover on land, since 1967 in Eurasian Arctic, and there, June 2021 saw the third lowest values in that record, beginning there in the late 1960s. So snow cover really has been below average at this point for quite some time, now for 15 consecutive years in the North American Arctic. And this is a challenge for animals and also for water resources and humans who depend on these water resources and ecosystems too.
Yes, I noticed in the 2021 Arctic Report card there was more emphasis on the changes for humans who live there. Do you want to talk to us about that a little?
That's true. We have been feeling recently that we would really like the Arctic Report card to help people understand that there's a significant population of people living in the Arctic, and they are really needing to rely on communities, neighbors, traditions, and find ways to be resilient in the face of these changes. And so we've been looking for ways to be able to discuss the people influences that all of these Arctic changes have, not just for those of us far from the Arctic, but also for residents of the Arctic, and discuss how they've been dealing with some of these changes occurring.
The Arctic Report card says, quote, 7 of the 9 Arctic regions observed show higher ocean primary productivity in 2021 than the long-term average. What does that mean, and why does it matter?
Yes, primary productivity helps us think about really the base of the Arctic Ocean food chain. And it's not entirely clear what this higher primary productivity, how that might lead to other ecosystem changes, because there are other changes going on, for example, losses of sea ice that are really challenging to some of our marine animals. So it's unclear still the full influence of this increase in primary productivity. And I do want to point out that this increase in primary productivity, much as we discussed with tundra greening, where we could have this kind of pan-Arctic greening of the vegetation, primary productivity is an area where we can also see extreme or unusual events that show low productivity for specific locations or times of year, too. So across these different metrics that look at the full Arctic or might sum up an entire year, there are a lot of really interesting and important nuances location to location, as well as we look at different seasons.
It appears Greenland lost less ice in 2021 than in previous years. Does that mean we're doing better at controlling climate change or what?
I sure wish that I could say that was true. It is good news that this was not another record year of ice loss from the Greenland ice sheet. I, as a person who myself focuses my own research most specifically on the Greenland ice sheet, I'm always glad to see a year where ice loss is a bit less. Nonetheless, this is now another year, and it's now been every year since 1998 that we have seen ice loss from the Greenland ice sheet, and any ice loss is contributing to shrinking of the ice sheet and to sea level rise around the world. And interestingly, even in spite of having this somewhat lower ice loss this year than some of the recent years that we've seen, there were still some remarkable and unprecedented events for the Greenland ice sheet. This summer, we actually had three extreme melt events on the Greenland ice sheet, and was only the second summer on record. The other was 2012, which was a record ice loss year, in which we had two different extreme melt events where more than half of the ice sheet surface was experiencing melt at the same time. And we also had another very, well, unprecedented event, and that was in mid-August. There's a research station up at the summit of the Greenland ice sheet. This is more than 10,000 feet, more than 3,000 meters above sea level rise, really in the deep interior of the ice sheet. And the scientists there experienced hard rain at the summit. And we've never before recorded rain at the summit of the ice sheet.
Well, one of the best known indicators is the Arctic sea ice. The public has heard about that. What can you say about that this year?
Arctic sea ice, this was another year of low Arctic sea ice. Thankfully, it was not a record low for the extent. So there are many, many metrics that we look at for sea ice. One of them is imagining looking down from space and how much area is that sea ice covering. And this was not a record minimum, which we measure usually in September. However, the 15 lowest extents have all occurred in the last 15 years, which is kind of another way of saying that the ice extents that we saw prior to 2007, we haven't been able to recover to those kinds of quantities or area coverage of sea ice. And along with measuring this area covered by sea ice, we also think about the age and the thickness of the sea ice. So sea ice that stays around through a summer is going to, in that following winter, grow more. So it's gaining another year of age, and it's also usually getting thicker. And unfortunately, this, what we call multi-year sea ice, has seen very dramatic losses. And for 2021, we saw our second lowest levels of multi-year sea ice, and this based on a record that began in 1985. So we're losing some of this important, older, thicker ice in the Arctic.
There's a couple of strange new developments in the new report card, like a garbage event and the impact of beavers. Why include that?
Well, these are areas where we're looking as Arctic Report Card editors for areas of new research or sometimes surprising events. And we noticed news from local communities on these marine garbage events were really remarkable. They were having reports of amounts of garbage that they'd never seen before in the coastal areas. This was in the Bering Strait, which is the kind of coastal area of Alaska in this case, where Alaska is kind of reaching over towards the Russian side as well. And they were seeing remarkable amounts of garbage, and also that much of this garbage seemed to be quite new. And as we're losing sea ice in the Arctic, and as animals and fish are migrating sometimes further north than before, residents in the Arctic are experiencing the impacts of more industrial shipping activity in the Arctic. And unfortunately, this garbage event appears to be part of that trend and helps to remind us that there's really a lot of international activity in the Arctic, and it's going to require international cooperation if, for example, we're going to prevent having more of these garbage events into the future. And I think as far as the beaver expansion into the Arctic, this was an area that has been noted by Arctic residents in Alaska. And they've been noting more beaver instances. And as scientists were beginning to look at data collected from satellites, they were measuring how many beaver ponds there were in the Alaska tundra. And they found that the number of beaver ponds had doubled since 2000. And as beavers create these surface ponds, it creates a watery, wet surface. And that actually can also add to destabilizing the permafrost or frozen ground underneath it. So it's not entirely clear what is going to be the extent of the transformation of the ecosystem in the Arctic due to this expansion of beavers. but it may not be sort of the positive beaver story that we sometimes have in lower mid-latitudes.
From so many scientists, we hear developments in the Arctic will change the whole world. I wonder, do you think we need a single well-funded agency to monitor the far north more, or is it enough to depend on spending by national governments?
I certainly welcome additional focus on the Arctic, and I think that the realization of how important the Arctic is has continued to grow, and I mean realizing the importance of it as part of our Earth system and really part of the Earth's cooling system, but also an increased realization that there's a lot of activity there geopolitically, a lot of changes underway that are going to influence shipping, economies, industrial activity. And so I think that many area groups are playing catch-up to being attentive to the changes occurring in the Arctic. And I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure whether we would be better served by introducing a new organization or agency that would focus entirely on this, or by increasing our efforts to weave together the different groups and activities that do look at the Arctic. But I think there's no question that the Arctic is becoming an increasingly important area for us to pay attention to, and for a variety of reasons.
Well, I think along with my listeners, I kind of worry that there could be a major tipping point occurring there, but it's so far away from the rest of us that it could go on until we don't notice it too late.
I agree that it's very important that we have ongoing monitoring activities, and some of them can be very challenging. For example, we have an essay this year on ocean acidification, and measurements at areas of the Arctic suggest that it may be experiencing higher ocean acidification rates than anywhere else on the globe in areas of the Arctic Ocean, but it's such a difficult area to study. It's a very difficult environment to have instruments in or set up long-term monitoring. So we're thankful for the many resources that come from satellites, although few of them can really take data all the way to the North Pole. And there are many challenges with doing research in the field. So I think scientists are working hard to bring many different tools and also invent new tools that can help with this. But I agree that it's an area of concern as far as being attentive to the changes happening. And I think not just for the Arctic, but for climate change broadly, we should be quite concerned about taking rapid action so that the changes that we implement can take effect sooner rather than later, because there are enough of these vicious amplifying loops that get started and then continue that I'm quite concerned that we don't get to a point where we have delayed action so long that the actions we take will have little influence. Whereas we're at a time right now where we can see quite clearly from computer simulations that taking action can have a large influence.
Twyla, as we wrap up here, I noticed that you've been exploring and publishing science about this for over a dozen years. You seem to take it kind of personally. Do you feel like you've developed a relationship with some of the glaciers?
There's no question that I feel like I have a relationship with some of these glaciers. I have been studying the Greenland ice sheet for going on 2 decades. And it's amazing to me, even the smallest little area of Greenland, if it was a natural feature, for example, here in my backyard in Montana, it would be considered a national treasure, and everyone would be going to visit it. But because Greenland is somewhat remote and it's so large, some of these glaciers maybe barely have names, but I have come to recognize them and see the changes. And unfortunately, the ice sheet that I see and monitor today is already very different from the ice sheet that I fell in love with as a student, and it's difficult to watch these changes happen. But the ice sheet also reminds me that we are still in such an important opportunity space and that we're really undertaking actions today that will create a legacy that lasts for tens of thousands of years. And I cannot think of a more exciting place to be involved than a taking actions for the Earth system that are really going to last for millennia.
From Boulder, Colorado, we've been speaking with Dr. Twyla Moon, Deputy Lead Scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. You can find links to the Arctic Report Card update at arctic.noaa.gov, or you can find easy links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.